Good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for braving this bitter cold to hear about a bittersweet novel. I'm Katie Stover, Director of Reader Services, and if you wonder what I do all day, what does the Director of Reader Services do all day, I can assure you it is not reading. But every once in a while, I'm handed a book that grabs me and makes me call in reading, you know, like calling in sick. And this is a condition that only librarians and readers contract, and I can assure you it is a perfectly acceptable excuse in the right settings, such as a library or a bookstore or a college English class. Because good fiction takes readers on journeys to different times and places, introduces them to fascinating new people and ideas. Great fiction gives readers an opportunity to examine their own values and beliefs while experiencing those of others. Great fiction takes those large global or national issues and puts them in a setting and a context that makes the reader think, hey, that could be me or my family or my community. Great fiction helps us expand our worldview, develop empathy, and articulate what it means to be a thoughtful, engaged member of the human race, despite, or maybe even because of, our very human flaws. Tonight, Sandra Moran will talk to us about her novel, Letters Never Sent. And it's a deft mix of historical fiction, romance, and mystery surrounding three women who love each other. Letters Never Sent has been given numerous awards, the 2013 Rainbow Award for Best Lesbian Historical Romance and Best Lesbian Debut Novel. And this year it won the Golden Crown Literary Society's General Fiction Award and the Anne Bannon Popular Choice Award. One could shelve Letters Never Sent under the genre heading of LGBT fiction. It could just as easily be shelved with historical fiction, women's fiction, or psychological fiction. Your library tries very hard not to place labels on your reading material, because we don't place labels on our readers. Let's just call it fiction. But not you. You're real. Real readers. So, our special guest author tonight is an assistant adjunct professor of anthropology at Johnson County Community College, an instructor for the Golden Crown Literary Society, and the recipient of numerous awards for her novels, ones I did not even begin to mention. And she has two other novels under her belt, Nudge and The Addendum. Please welcome Sandra Moran.
Thank you so much. Wow. First, let me thank you for coming out on what is quite possibly a polar vortexian sort of evening. I have to say that I've been really fortunate in that I've had the opportunity to travel all over the United States speaking about Letters Never Sent. But there's just something about being in your hometown with your people and your crowd that just feels different. And as much of a geek as it may make me sound, this is probably the highlight of my writing career thus far, to be able to present at the iconic Kansas City Public Library. It's just such a thrill. And so I'm really, really honored and pleased to see all of you. Tonight, I'm going to be talking about culture, gender roles, and lesbianism as depicted in Letters Never Sent. Now, as Katie mentioned, I do teach anthropology at Johnson County Community College. And one of the aspects of my novels, or my classes, that I find most fascinating are discussions about sexual paradigms and cultural paradigms as they relate to gender expectations and sexuality. Now, one of the things that I tell my students is that we are, all of us, products of our environments. Whether we like it or not, the rules and expectations of our society shape who we are. They shape what we believe, and they often dictate how we're supposed to act. Now, it's a great device for keeping social order, if people know what they're supposed to do. It's not a good thing if you're someone who struggles to live within those confines, which is the case for several of the characters in Letters Never Sent. Now, I'm not sure how many of you have read the book, so as a quick summary, Letters Never Sent is the story of three women, Kate, Annie, and Joan. And the novel opens in 1997 when Joan, who is Catherine's estranged daughter, travels to Lawrence, Kansas to clean out her mother's home. She's going to be selling it, even though she isn't sure that she wants to. And for Joan, it's a challenging trip on a number of levels. Her relationship with her mother has always been challenging, and she dreads being in her childhood home because it evokes bad memories. But she also has some personal decisions to make. She's in a loveless marriage. She has been having an affair with her boss, and she is pregnant with his child. So she is going through the home, and she's preparing it for sale. And as she's cleaning, she finds an old suitcase in the back of her mother's closet. And it contains a wooden book, or a wooden box full of trinkets, a spent bullet casing, and a packet of sealed love letters, which she reads. Of course she does. Who wouldn't, right? And it's through these unsent letters that she discovers a woman who is completely different from the cold and uncompromising mother who raised her. She comes to know a woman who struggled to conform to society's expectations and who loved deeply and lost that love to circumstances both within and outside of her control. Interestingly enough, she also comes to realize that despite the fact that her mother was functioning within the paradigms of the 1930s and 40s, and Joan was functioning in the paradigms of the 1990s, their lives were in many ways paralleled. And that begs the question of how could that be? I mean, we're talking about 60 years of advancement that saw the women's liberation movement, bra burning, Gloria Steinem. Surely all of that must have exacted some change. And it did, but honestly, not as much as you might think. Even today, 50 years after President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act in an effort to abolish wage discrimination based on gender, women are still paid 78 cents for every dollar that a man earns. And this is especially evident for women who are in their childbearing years. Now, I mention this only because one of the things that I came to realize as I was researching Letters Never Sent was that even though society has and continues to change, in many ways those deeply ingrained concepts of what is considered appropriate, what is considered feminine, quite honestly have remained the same. And it's those underlying themes that I want to talk about tonight. What I'm going to be doing, hopefully successfully, is couching what was going on nationally and internationally and how those changes impacted the characters in Letters Never Sent. Now, before I begin, I want to be clear about the fact that this is a very general overview, and it's designed solely to give provenience to the story. It is by no means exhausting, although I would be happy to discuss it in excruciating detail with anyone who wants to talk about it after the presentation. So, societal expectations of women during the last century. It's really tempting to think of societal change regarding women as the slow progression, but that was in fact not the case. It was much more the opposite, more like a wave with vacillations between less and more permissive eras. Now, up until the 19th century, the accepted cultural norms were that women belonged in the home, and their responsibilities were what we consider, quote unquote, traditional: cooking, cleaning, taking care of the children, and providing a welcoming home for her husband. But in 1890, something happened that changed that for many women, particularly those women who were living in larger cities. And I'm, of course, talking about the Progressive Era. Now, I know that you guys know what the Progressive Era is, but I'm going to go ahead and real quickly cover it. The Progressive Era was a 40-year span that was characterized by social activism and political reform in the United States. Now, I want to be clear about the fact that the Progressive Era wasn't about women's rights, at least not initially. It was more about social reform, of exposing corruption and getting rid of the inefficiency, waste, and injustices of the Gilded Age. During the Progressive Era, modernization and a better, more temperate society were the goals. And we can see this reform in a number of arenas, with the most famous, of course, being prohibition. And then later, the suffrage movement. Now, both of these issues were key for exacting societal change because they allowed women to step onto the public stage and to have a voice for the first time about issues. Later, they were then able to take that and have a voice for themselves. And by banding together through activism, these women were able to carve out previously unavailable freedoms, including in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which, of course, allowed women the right to vote. So we start out with a less permissive society, and by the 1920s, we see a society that has become significantly more permissive. Now, the 1920s were pivotal for women. Married white women, and I need to stress that as I am talking about this, I'll be talking about white women. This is the African-American women experienced something that was very, very different. So I want to be clear about that. During the 1920s, married white women began to get more education and subsequently were having not just families, but also jobs. And this is noted, interestingly enough, not only in the demographics, but also in articles in women's magazines, where they promoted the idea that a fulfilling life for a woman required marriage, children, and work outside the home. And single white women were also experiencing a change. Suddenly, they were able to live on their own, they were able to get jobs, and they were able to date around. Now, the most extreme of these single women were, of course, the flappers. These bold, audacious women who challenged old ways of thinking and demanded the same liberties and freedoms as men. Now, it should come as no surprise that with these new paradigms came new perspectives on sexual freedom. Now, because these single women were becoming more self-reliant, they no longer needed to marry for financial security. They were able to make their own money, which changed the dynamic regarding their relationships with men. They didn't necessarily need them to take care of them. So what you see is a relationship that's much more casual and oftentimes more sexual. Now, the women of the 1920s strove for economic independence. And although there were some professional women who opposed the fusing of these two worlds, many single white women basked in the opportunity to have education and professions and independence and freedom. And this is where I return to the characters in Letters Never Sent. The changes that I'm talking about were much more pronounced and accepted, arguably, in larger cities. And as we all know, in places like Big Springs, Kansas, which is where Kate's from, change happened much more slowly. There, girls like Kate who wanted something more were in the minority, and they faced confusion and condemnation from their friends and family. Now for Kate, the expectation was that she was going to marry a local boy, she was going to settle down, she was going to have kids, and she would never travel more than 20 miles from the place that she was born. It was what it was expected, but it wasn't what she wanted. Kate was of this new generation of girls who wanted a job, who wanted to see the world, who wanted to be independent. But her outspokenness often put her at odds with her mother and her friends, and particularly her boyfriend, who didn't understand why she would want to do something like this. Now, her struggle, I would argue, both internal and external, mimics what we see on a smaller scale, the growing pains that we see at the society at large. And this is illustrated on in a scene that is on page 24, which immediately follows Kate's sister's wedding. Now, Kate is standing with her friend Evelyn and the boy she's dating, Albert. And Albert has been trying unsuccessfully to woo Kate. And so I'm going to read from the novel now. So you want to go for a ride? Kate and Evelyn stood in the shade of one of the towering oaks that bordered the edge of the church property. Albert gestured to his father's car. Oh, I can't. Kate glanced over at Jeannie, who was basking in all the attention. Maid of honor and all of that, I have to stay. Albert grinned good-naturedly. How about I come over after? Kate ignored Evelyn, who was looking down at her shoes, and smiled. It was common knowledge that Albert was in love with Kate and that his attempts at courtship were not going as smoothly as he would have liked. "I have to help Jeannie pack," Kate said. Albert's grin faded slightly. "Well, what about one night this week? We could go for a walk, or we could go to Lawrence." When Katie didn't answer, Albert sighed and leaned forward. "Katie, why are you doing this?" "You know why," Katie said. Albert frowned but said nothing. She'd explained to him many times that she wasn't playing hard to get. She simply didn't want to give him the wrong impression. He wanted to propose and she wanted to leave Big Springs and move to a large city as soon as she was 18. Those plans didn't include a husband. Evelyn had once asked her why she seemed so uninterested in Albert. "He's nice and funny and handsome and he's rich. Well, his daddy is." "He is," Kate agreed. "He's all of those things. And if I were interested in settling down and staying in Big Springs all my life, I'd probably pay him more mind. But Evie, that's not what I want." "Albert or Big Springs?" Evelyn had a soft, open face that made her thoughts and emotions entirely readable. Her expression showed that she was genuinely puzzled by Kate's words. "Neither," Kate said. "Is that bad to want more than this?" Kate swept her hand outward. "I want to see things and do things." "But how would you get by without a husband?" Evelyn asked. "What would you do?" "I'd get a job," Kate said simply. Evelyn looked stricken. "Where would you live?" "I'd take a room with a family, I suppose," Kate said. "But why?" Evelyn leaned forward and touched Kate's arm. "Why would you want to live in someone else's home when you could marry Albert and have a family of your own? I'm sure Albert would take you to the city if you asked him." Her eyes grew bright with excitement. "Maybe on your honeymoon, you two could go to Kansas City or Chicago." "Evie, I don't want to just visit," Kate said. "I want to live there. I want to walk down the streets. I want to see people." Evelyn shook her head. "Well, I don't know why." She paused thoughtfully. "But you better be careful, or Albert will find someone else." As Kate lay in bed that night, she wondered what was wrong with her that she wanted nothing to do with marriage or children. She thought about Evelyn's reaction. She'd been perplexed. And why would someone like Kate, someone who had the option of getting married to a man like Albert, want to go off to by herself to a large city and work a job? It was a good question, and one Kate had asked herself more than once with always the same answer. She simply wanted to have a life different than the one she was expected to have. With a frustrated sigh, Kate rolled onto her side and stared at the shadows the trees cast on her wall by the light of the moon. She'd never been like the rest of her friends and family. They wanted the safety of their uncomplicated lives, and she wanted what? Travel? Adventure? "It's not healthy," her mother often said, "this obsession with books and far-off places. It just makes you want what you can't have. You need to be out with your friends, not filling your head with places you're never going to see. You're 17. You're going to be graduated soon. You need to be thinking about settling down with Albert and giving me some grandbabies, not running off to Egypt or Paris or wherever it is you think you need to go." "Mama, please," Kate had said in exasperation. "I don't want to get married straight off. You know that." "Well, a woman can't wait too long," her mother had responded, giving her the once-over. "You're young now and pretty enough, but that'll fade." "Wait too long? And the good ones will all be taken." Now again, Kate's experience and the conversations with her mother and friends were not all that different from other girls from small towns who were fighting against familial and long-held societal expectations. But all around the U.S. during this time, more and more girls shook off these expectations, and they went to the big cities, and they took jobs, traditional jobs, as teachers and nurses and secretaries and shop girls. They took a chance to get for themselves what they wanted. Now, I should be clear about the fact that most of these women were heterosexual. But something that's interesting about this is that the changes in society that afforded women generally this independence also allowed for lesbians to have a certain amount of freedom to live much more openly. Because this type of independent behavior was becoming more accepted, women who identified as lesbians were less likely to be questioned about their choices to have jobs, to have female roommates, and to live in female-centric spaces. I say this, but with the caveat that what I'm telling you is what little information that we have. There's a lot less documentation of lesbianism in the early 20th century than there is about male homosexuality. And there are probably a few reasons for this. Probably the biggest one was that most of the people who were doing research about homosexuality were men, and they were looking at male homosexuality. Secondly, I think you can make the argument that lesbianism was much less obvious and, as such, attracted much less attention. It was, and it still is, actually more culturally acceptable for women to be demonstrative, to kiss in greeting, to kiss and hug goodbye, to walk arm in arm. And then, because this show of female affection is more natural, lesbianism was much less persecuted because it wasn't considered as offensive. It was considered natural. And also, interestingly enough, because in terms of legal prosecution, most of the laws, which incidentally were made by men, were concerned with the act of penetration, something that you could prove, I guess, though I don't know how you would go about getting that proof. Probably don't want to know. The other thing that we see as well is that women tended to be much less out. They were able to live fairly, quote-unquote, normal lives under the radar. In fact, we really don't see much in the way of depictions of lesbianism in the general public until the 1928 publication in the United Kingdom of a novel by Radcliffe Hall. And I'm, of course, talking about The Well of Loneliness, which, incidentally, is the book that I had Annie give Kate as a means of trying to make her aware of her sexual orientation. Now, what's interesting about this is that the publication of the book, although controversial, didn't necessarily have the intended reaction here in the United States. There's some evidence to suggest that not all lesbians were happy to have the publication of a story like this. In an article titled Lesbianism in the 1920s and 30s, published in the summer of 1977 in the journal Science, researchers Vern and Bonnie Ballou discuss an unpublished manuscript which was willed to them by a lesbian that they identify only as by the initials MB. Now, the manuscript, which dates to 1938, was written when the author was about 40, and she was in college and was working on a master's thesis, which ultimately ended up not really going anywhere. But what she tried to do was put together a scholarly description of her life and the lives of her friends and her partner. And in it, she discusses how a typical reaction to Well of Loneliness were, in fact, fears that the novel would cause people, and this is a direct quote, who before had never heard of lesbianism to try to classify as a lesbian, every woman who wore a suit with a skirt and was seen more than once in the company of another woman. So they were concerned that this would actually bring attention to them when they were trying to live their lives by, you know, being very, very subtle. So that begs the question of, was this woman and her group of friends a good representation of the lesbian community at the time? And interestingly enough, in many respects, yes, they were. At the time of the interviews, the ages of the 25 women that were detailed in this manuscript ranged from 19 to 56, with a median age of 29. Their occupations included 6 teachers, both high school and college, 2 nurses, 2 waitresses, 2 secretaries, a mining engineer, a beauty operator, a barber, a photographer, who was the author, 1 social worker, who was her partner, 1 concession operator, a farm laborer, 3 housewives who identified as lesbian but were married to men, and 2 housewife partners of lesbian women, and then 1 person who was identified as a temporarily unemployed drifter, which sounds kind of sketchy, but Now, what's interesting about this group, aside from the fact that all of them, or almost all of them, have jobs outside of the home, is that they all manage to live their lives as lesbians without detection. Now, we see the same thing, I hope, in Letters Never Sent with the character of Annie, and then later, Kate, who by 1933 has left Big Springs and now lives in Chicago, where, to the consternation of her friends and family, works at the glove counter at the Sears and Roebuck department store. She lives in a boarding house in near North Chicago, which was where a lot of single people lived because it was inexpensive. It was an artist enclave, and there were, even though she didn't realize it when she moved there, there were a lot of homosexuals that lived there. And she's also made some friends. She lives in the same boarding house as her friend Claire, and she's become friends with Annie, who is an outspoken feminist. Now, this is a pivotal time in American history, because in 1933, the stock market crash of 1929 was a not-so-distant memory. The Great Depression was in full swing, but the upside was that Prohibition had been repealed, and so people were at least able to drink, so that was a good thing. Now, the thing about the Great Depression is that it changed the playing field regarding women's independence. The freedoms of the 1920s were replaced by a return to more traditional gender roles. The social climate during this time was very austere. People were struggling to make ends meet, and there weren't a lot of jobs. The jobs that were out there were more often than not given to men. Women had a significant onus placed on them because they were encouraged to focus on the welfare of their families rather than going out and making money and working. And we see this in a number of different ways. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt got into the act in her 1933 book titled, It's Up to the Women, where she appealed to women to keep their families strong and to do what it took to guide America through this economic crisis. Now, I mention this because for women like Kate and Annie and Claire, there was a tremendous amount of pressure from their family and from society at large to get married, to leave their jobs open for the men, and to focus on children and a family. And this pressure was seen in a variety of different ways, both overt with Eleanor Roosevelt's book, but also really subtly in ways such as the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. Now, the theme of the fair was the century of progress, and it was designed to show a promising future for the nation through the advancement of science and technology. But apparently, this didn't include women. Despite everything accomplished by women during the Progressive Era, the century of progress had very little to do with social justice, equality, or gender-related accomplishments, or, quite honestly, personal freedoms and freedom of expression. In fact, in the 1933 World's Fair, women were fairly ignored, which was markedly different than the 1893 Columbia Exposition, which was also held in Chicago. And for anyone who's read Devil in the White City, that's the one that had a significant presence of women. Now, interestingly enough, in 1893, there was U.S. federal legislation that mandated the inclusion of women's exhibits in the fair. In 1933, there was no such congressional mandate. And as a result, women found very little representation. There was no women's building, as there had been before. There were very few exhibits that depicted the contributions of women to America's national progress. And most of the women that were represented at the fair were entertainment. Sally Rand and her fan dance. It was a very different representation. Now, I mention this because, of course, part of the novel takes place at the Chicago World's Fair. But again, I think that this is an event that is a metaphor that you could argue frames the entire novel, and that it illustrates the persistent and enduring societal expectations and gender roles that are placed on women at the time. And although it may have been the status quo, not all women accepted it. Many women fought against it, and many found ways around the social conventions. And in Letters, I tried to create in Kate, Annie, and Claire early mid-century female characters who challenged this social convention by doing some things like drinking and smoking and having premarital sex. Now, how each of these women struggled with these conventions varied. Annie faced these taboos head on. She lived audaciously. She refused to compromise or to be quiet about who she was. Claire pretended not to want a husband and a family, although she actively pursues this ideal throughout the course of her part of the book. And Kate struggled to maintain this balance between the expectations of family and society with her innate desires as a woman and as a sexual creature and as someone who is beginning to recognize her attraction to Annie. And this is perhaps best illustrated in a conversation on page 58 between Kate and Annie in the employee break room at Sears and Roebuck. Now, Annie has been disowned by her family for her lifestyle choices and is going home to Big Springs with Kate for Christmas. And this is before anything of significance has happened between Kate and Annie. They're still considered just friends. So as they eat lunch, Kate asks Annie to be discreet about their activities in Chicago. And the other thing, Kate said in a rush, and I know I don't need to say this, but I really feel like I should anyway. Please don't tell them about some of the things we do here. They don't understand my life, and they wouldn't like knowing that I drink or dance or see boys or, well, any of the things we do, really. They wouldn't approve. Ah, Annie said knowingly and grinned. Don't say it like that, Kate said. Her face warm. It's not like we're doing anything wrong. It's just that they're small town provincial people. They're kind, but, well, you know, narrow in their thinking. Annie frowned. Maybe this isn't such a good idea. You know how I am. It will be fine, Kate said. Just follow my lead. Has Claire ever met your family? Annie took another bite of her sandwich. No, Kate said, though not for any reason other than that she hasn't had the opportunity. You know, I'd like you to get to know Claire better. You'd like her a lot, I think. But would she like me? Annie asked. I really don't think she approves of our friendship. Really? Kate said. Why do you say that? Just the way she looks at me, Annie said. Kate shook her head, even though she had noticed the same thing. Oh, I don't think that's it. She's never said anything like that to me. Annie shrugged. Or maybe she's just jealous. You've been spending a lot of time with me lately, and wasn't that time that you used to spend with her? Well, yes, Kate admitted, but not that much lately, not since she started seeing Lenny. What do you think of Lenny? Annie asked. Kate hesitated. He's fun, and he laughs a lot. Not necessarily a ringing endorsement, Annie said. He just drinks a lot, Kate said, and when Claire is with him, she does too. She's just a different person when she's around him. Are they sleeping together? Annie asked. Annie, Kate exclaimed, that's none of our business. So they are. Annie nodded. You know, I'm not surprised. So what if they are, Kate said. Oh, believe me, I don't have a problem with it, Annie said. If that's what you're into, it's fine by me. Don't judge lest you be judged. Judge not that ye be not judged, Kate corrected. Matthew 7:1. Annie raised her eyebrows. A student of the Bible, so you're a Christian. You can't not be a Christian where I'm from, Kate said. Though I'm not as devout as the rest of my family, especially in regard to going to church. So is that why you don't approve of Claire and Lenny? Annie asked, because they're having premarital sex. Annie... Shh. Kate looked fearfully around the room. So that is it. Annie's voice was triumphant. No, Kate sat up straighter. That's not it. So you have no problem with premarital sex, Annie said. Now you're just being argumentative, Kate said. And you haven't answered the question. Annie had a strange gleam in her eye. If you love someone, I think it's less of a sin than just doing it to do it, Kate said finally. And have you? Annie asked. Annie, that's none of your... Have you? Yes, Kate said. I have. His name was... is... Alex, and we dated this past spring and summer. Not that it's any of your business, actually. So what happened? Annie asked. Why did it end? Kate shrugged and shifted her gaze from Annie's face to the remains of her soup. She waited, hoping that Annie would let it go. She didn't. We just had different ideas as to where the relationship was going, Kate said finally. That's all. Why are you so interested in my love life? So you ended it, Annie said. In a manner of speaking, Kate said, yes, but honestly, I'd rather not discuss it. Hey, how about you? Kate asked, anxious to steer the conversation away from her. What about you? Are you seeing anyone? Do you date much? I go out, Annie said, and I've had a couple of relationships, and yes, before you asked, they were sexual. I wasn't going to ask, Kate said quickly. It's okay. I'm not ashamed. I think that sexual expression is a God-given right, and I think that men are intimidated by that, so they call those of us who are comfortable with our sexuality whores, or they suggest that we're immoral. It's ridiculous, really. Annie's voice rose. If men can have sex without remorse, then so should we be able to as well, without judgment or recrimination. Annie. Kate looked around to see if anyone was listening. People can hear you. There's nothing wrong with it, Annie continued. I'm sexual, but I'm not easy. I do what I want and with whom. I'm the one in control. I'm the one who's making decisions. Kate nodded uneasily, hoping that that was the end of the conversation. Annie sat back defiantly, almost as if she expected Kate to challenge her. Finally, Kate sighed, leaned forward, and said in a low voice, listen, it's not that I think you're not entitled to your opinion. It's just that I don't think it's appropriate to have these kinds of discussions in the employee break room. Okay, Annie leaned forward, mocking Kate's pose. I'll stop, but only if you answer one question. What do you think? Do women deserve the same rights as men when it comes to sex? Annie, Kate said in exasperation, I don't know. I guess, yes, I think that women deserve equal rights, but I'm not sure that anyone, male or female, should be engaging in premarital sex on a habitual basis. It's a sin. Huh. Funny, Annie said, her voice so low. I didn't peg you as such a prude. I am not a prude, Kate exclaimed and slammed her hand down on the table. Occupants of the other tables turned to stare. Annie grinned. Could you keep your voice down, please? I have a reputation to think about. So what I hope that this illustrates is that all three of these women were grappling with the cultural constructs of the early 1930s in different ways. But what they didn't realize is that as they were trying to navigate this and find ways to make it work for them, that the playing field was about to change again. And of course, I'm talking about the U.S. entering World War II. Now, when the U.S. decided to enter the war in 1941, a couple of things happened that significantly changed the cultural paradigm. Men were, as you know, drafted to fight, and women who had recently been pushed out of the workplace were suddenly seen as this tremendously valuable workforce. And not just for the traditional jobs that they'd held before, jobs such as nurses and teachers and librarians, but jobs that were considered masculine, jobs that allowed them a freedom to do things that before had been denied to them. Now, during the war years, interestingly enough, women constituted more than one-third of the workforce. And by 1944, nearly half of all adult women, regardless of their marital status, social class, race, or sexual orientation, had worked at one time or another for pay. Suddenly, with the men gone, there were more jobs than there were people to fill them. And this provided all women with a tremendous opportunity to have freedom. And even beginning in 1942, with the congressional enactment of legislation that created the WACS, the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, for the first time they were actually able to enter into the military. Now, the jobs that they did in the military, by and large, were considered clerical and things like that, but not entirely. There were some women that were allowed. There were some women who flew planes, who did mechanical work. Now, all of these developments meant unparalleled freedoms for women generally, and lesbians specifically. In their book, Boots of Leather, Slippers of Gold, authors Elizabeth Kennedy and Madeline Davis examine the experiences of 45 lesbians during World War II. And what they find is that the war years had a tremendous impact on lesbian life in that with the men away at war, lesbians were able to have much more active, much more open social lives. They were able to interact publicly with women, and they were able to spend time with women who not only were lesbians, but also were straight. And so they were able to establish communities. Another thing that plays into this, as silly as it might sound, is that there were also changes in clothing norms. And by this I mean that it was suddenly acceptable for women to go into a store and purchase pants, dungarees. You see pictures of Rosie the Riveter, and you know, women are beginning to be able to wear clothing that in the past has been considered masculine. And when this happens, because it was more acceptable to wear these kinds of clothes anywhere, lesbians didn't stand out as much. They could express themselves much more freely. Something else that is interesting, or at least I think it is that women were working jobs, they were making money, and they were creating lives for themselves that were not dependent on their men, who were potentially away fighting, were not dependent on anything but themselves. They were able to go out and do what they wanted to do. And as a result, divorce rates skyrocketed. When women were able to provide for themselves, they were making decisions not to stay in marriage. And women were again asserting their independence. That was until things changed again. And when the war ended, the soldiers came home. And not only did they want their jobs back, but they wanted a return to a life that was calm. They wanted the American dream. They wanted a wife. They wanted the kids. They wanted a home in the suburbs. They wanted to have the separation with their family and their wife in one place and their work in another. Now, the post-war era of the 1940s and early 1950s saw an increase in marriages and, as of course we all know, a baby boom that has exceeded anything seen before or since. Again, married white women moved back into the home, and across the U.S., there was a shift in the social perception of women that worked, and that is that they shouldn't. They should want to be home in their nice homes with their husband that comes home. And interestingly enough, I posted on Facebook last night something that I found from my anthropology classes that I sometimes use as an example, and it's from, I think it was Good Housekeeping, and it was a list of 10 things that a good 1940s wife should do, including making sure that the children are clean and that you have a bow in your hair when you greet your husband when he comes home from work at the end of the day. Don't bore him with stories about your life. For anyone who's interested in seeing this, I'll post it on my webpage or my website so that you can see it. It seems so foreign that was the accepted norm. And I'll come back to that in just a second. But the idea was that this new paradigm was that the new suburban housewife ideally was supported by her husband where she managed the household and cared for the children. And in regard to letters never sent, and I know that I am kind of skipping around a little bit, but I don't want to give too much away if you haven't read the novel, because there's some stuff that happens that if I read too much, you're going to be like, oh, okay. So in regard to letters never sent, this plays out in that Kate ultimately bows to social and familial pressure. And she ultimately marries a man she doesn't love, becomes pregnant with Joan, and becomes a very unwilling mother. Again, it wasn't what she wanted, but it was what was expected of her and what was part of the social construct of the time. And to illustrate this, I am going to read a final excerpt from the novel. Now, to couch this, Kate has ended her relationship with Annie. She has moved back to Big Springs, and she is living with her mother. She has no job, she has no money, and she has no independence. The only way that she can see how to get out from under her mother's scrutiny is to marry Clyde, who is a local widower. And her mother supports this. In fact, she is actively encouraging this and inviting Clyde over for Sunday dinner, which is where we pick up. They have just finished eating, and they're walking along the lane. "That was sure good ham," Clyde said as he hurried to keep up with Catherine's quick pace. His scuffed boots kicked up tiny puffs of dust as he walked. "It was," Kate agreed. "Your mama's a good cook," he said, and then asked suddenly, "Do you like to cook?" "Not really," Kate said. "I didn't have much opportunity when I lived in Chicago, and now," she shrugged, "I help mama, but she does most of the cooking." "But you can cook," Clyde said. Kate stopped walking and turned to face him. "Yes, Clyde," she said, "I can cook." He nodded, ignoring the sharpness of her tone. "How do you like living at home?" he asked. Kate narrowed her eyes, but Clyde continued to look down at his shoes. He continued his train of thought. "I just figure it must be hard, you know, after being on your own for so long." Catherine blinked and drew slightly back, surprised to find that his tone was one of genuine concern. "It's been an adjustment," she admitted. "I can tell you're not happy," he said softly. "Whenever I see you, you seem so sad, so lonely." Kate pressed her lips together and shrugged. "Most of my friends here are married with family," she said, "and I'm stuck on the farm with mama and daddy. No job, no money, no means of doing anything on my own." She was surprised at her honesty. "What if you didn't have to go back there?" Clyde asked finally. "Oh, I can't go back to Chicago," Catherine began. "No," Clyde said quickly. "What I meant was, what if you didn't have to be at your mama's house?" "There aren't any jobs here that would pay me enough to live on my own," Catherine said bitterly. "What if you got married?" "Married," Catherine laughed bitterly. "That's the last thing I want to do." "What if it weren't a real marriage?" he asked. Kate turned to look at him confusedly. "What do you mean?" "Well," he said slowly, "I know you love someone else, I can tell." Catherine opened her mouth to ask how he knew, but he held up his hand to stop her. "And I ain't never going to love nobody but Wilma, not really. So what if we was to get married? Not because we love each other, but because it would be good for both of us." He held up his hands again as she began to protest. "Just listen." With a sigh, Catherine nodded and moved to lean against the rail fence. "I know you don't love me, but you like me well enough, and I'll treat you right. I won't drink much or beat you. Sometimes I read things that I wrote and I'm like, wow. and we would be good company for each other. I get lonely and I need someone to take care of my house, to cook and clean. So get a housekeeper," Catherine snapped before she could stop herself. Clyde looked sternly at her for several seconds before continuing. "It would get you out of your mama's house," he said, "and it would give you respectability." He glanced fearfully at Catherine before continuing. "Now, I know everyone thinks you're an old maid, but you don't have to be. I could fix that for you, and you could have a place of your own." "I'm not an old maid," Catherine spat. "It's not necessary for a woman to marry if she doesn't want to. I could have married. I chose not to." "And you can choose again," Clyde said. "I'd give you your freedom as long as you were faithful to me." Catherine shook her head. "Clyde, I really do appreciate the offer, but I don't love you. And I don't want to be married to someone I don't love." "It doesn't have to be based on love," Clyde insisted. "We get along. We could be friends." "And what about the other?" Catherine asked, not because she was really considering the offer, but because she was curious. "The other?" he asked with a frown. "Other," Catherine said more meaningfully. "Oh," he said quickly and grinned self-consciously. "That. Well, I don't want children," Catherine said sharply. "Neither do I," Clyde said, and pushed his hat back on his head. His brow, Catherine could see, was sweaty. He glanced at Catherine and then away again. "I'm not going to say that I don't have needs," he said finally, But if you was to say yes, I wouldn't exercise my rights all that often, just enough to keep things in working order. And I could make sure that there were no babies. Catherine stared, trying to imagine Clyde as a lover, envisioning his sweaty body on top of hers. She remembered what it had been like with Alex. She remembered what it had been like with Annie. She felt suddenly sick. It could be good for both of us, Clyde was saying, if he was just to think about it. But I don't love you, Catherine said again, softly this time. You don't need to love me to marry me, Clyde said. I'll take whatever you give. And he had. They'd married quickly, consummated their marriage, and set out on a life based on companionship. She hadn't been happy, but she hadn't been unhappy. She was out of her mother's house, around family, and Clyde was true to his word about his sexual demands. It wasn't pleasant, but it wasn't horrible either. It simply was. What I think that we can see from that excerpt is that Kate has finally accepted and bowed to the gender roles of the time. And despite the fact that she had fallen in love with a woman, that she desperately wanted to be with that woman, Annie, and she wanted a life that allowed her to be free and assert her independence, ultimately she makes the decision to bow to the social pressure of getting married and mothering a child, which she doesn't want, and quite honestly is not a particularly good mother too. Like many of the women at the time, she did ultimately what was expected of her. And what I think is even more interesting is we see that her daughter, so many years later, does a lot of the same things. She makes the decision to get married. She makes the decision to have children, not because she necessarily wants to, but because she wants to prove to her mother that she can do it better than her mom ever did. And ultimately, she comes to resent her children a great deal. And I'm going to close by saying that we talk about these changes. We look at how society has impacted the expectation of what is feminine, what is a woman supposed to do. And arguably, they've changed a great deal. But I think we should also ask ourselves the question of whether or not they really have changed all that much. I talk to my students in my classes, and we discuss culture, we discuss gender, and we talk a lot about what's known as double workload. And in anthropology, double workload is where a woman goes out and she works a full-time job, and then she comes home and has responsibility for doing the laundry and cooking the dinner and taking care of the kids and doing all of these things. And women, regardless of their ages, and I have some that are in their early 20s all the way up into some that are in their 60s, who will say that, yes, things have changed, and yes, their husbands help out, but ultimately what it comes down to is there's still that expectation, at least they feel, that they have to have kids, that they really should be married, that the expectation is not all that much different than, you know, what we talk about in terms of the 1930s and 40s, at least inherently so. And so I guess I would ask the question, is there still a subtle pressure on women to adhere to these traditional gender roles? And I think that the argument could be made that, yes, there still is. So thank you so much for coming out and listening to me yammer on about gender roles and anthropology and letters. And I would be happy to stand for any questions if anyone has something they'd like to ask or anything. Yeah.
I'm really concerned that we're moving back the other direction because young women today in the millennial generation, which is, I think, around 1980 to the year 2000, the mothers worked outside the house. And the children didn't always get what they wanted, sometimes what they, not always what they needed. Mm-hmm. And so I see some reversal of that and rebellion to that by these young women having children early in their marriage, or maybe not getting married at all and still having children, mm-hmm. and trying to be the housewife. Mm-hmm. So I'm concerned that where women are concerned, we tend to be either or. Either you're okay if you go out and work the job and do the double load, mm-hmm. and you're not okay if you're a stay-at-home mom, or vice versa, you're not okay if you go out and work the job, do mm-hmm. the double load, and you stay at home. I mean, it's just like we women seem to do that. other, and I'm probably guilty of that myself in different things, although I didn't work all of my daughter's childhood because of some health problems and things. And actually, a little correction, this millennial generation is a bigger baby boom than we were.
Okay. Okay, cool. Thank you. Other questions? Question, Bueller? I actually say that sometimes in class. I'll say Bueller, Bueller, and they look at me, they have no idea what I'm talking about. None. I was using, as an example, the Brady Bunch the other day in class, and I look in the back of the room, and there are these two girls that are good students, and they were sitting there, and one of them leaned over, and I'm not an expert at reading lips, but this is pretty easy to see. One of them said, "What is she talking about?" And the other girl sitting next to her is like, "I don't know." Other questions? No? Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Sandra.
Thank you.